Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Doo.
And this is the podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what have you been reading on time this week?
I have been listening to an audiobook that was very good called Scoops by Sam McAllister, which is published by One World, came out earlier this year. And I was particularly interested in this because until relatively recently, Sam McAllister was sort of the interviews booker producer on Newsnight on the BBC. And this book is essentially her talking about some of the most memorable or biggest interviews that she worked on during her time at Newsnight. And now obviously the Prince Andrew, which is where the cover of the book comes from, because you see the chair that he was sitting in on the, you know, the very famous now interview that he did with Emily Maitlis. Probably about a third of the book is actually about that interview. It's about how they got the interview, how they set it up, the process they went through to get approval, the interview itself, how that all worked on the day, and then the kind of aftermath of it, which is really interesting. I mean, obviously that interview is, I mean, I strongly suspect is probably now being taught in journalism colleges of how not to do an interview, you know, astonishing interview that it was. But the rest of the book is, for my money, more interesting, although I did find the Prince Andrew interview stuff very interesting as well. It was them interviewing James Comey, who was the former director of the FBI, who had been sacked by Trump about 6 months in. And there was all the stuff around Russia and the director of the FBI having to say to Trump when he was looking likely to become president, "We have this information that you and some sex workers in Moscow, you know, there were golden showers and things." It's like, you know, imagine having to have that conversation with someone who was likely to become the president of the United States, regardless of who that person is. There's stuff about the worst interview she ever worked on, Amy Schumer. when they interviewed Julian Assange when he was still in the Ecuadorian embassy. When they interviewed the really extraordinary bit where they interviewed these women who had been held captive, they'd been kidnapped as, I think they were teenagers, and held captive for years and years and years in this guy's house until one day they got out, and they had the exclusive interview with these two women telling this incredible story. But the thing that appealed to me about it is, as regular listeners will know, I'm a book publicist in my day job. And she talks a lot about dealing with book publicists and obviously how a lot of these very big names, the way that they can get an interview on Newsnight with those people is because they've got a book coming out and they want to promote their book. So that's how they got Julian Assange, you know, when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, because there was a WikiLeaks book coming out. That's how they got James Comey. That's how they got Sean Spicer. I wanted to read the book because I don't know Sam McAllister at all. She certainly doesn't know me. She wouldn't know me from Adam, I'm sure. But I have pitched to Sam on a few occasions. We don't necessarily have those sort of very, very huge names in politics, but we certainly do publish books by political figures and people that I certainly think would be a perfectly good interview on Newsnight, which is when I've pitched to her. And the thing that I always really, really, really liked about Sam McAllister was, on nearly every occasion, if I pitched her something that was not going to be for Newsnight, she would reply and she would say, "Thank you, but no thank you." And honestly, in publicity, no is the second best answer you can get, because 9.9 times out of 10, just no one replies to you. And then you have to chase them. And then you feel like you're being a nuisance. And then you have to think, oh, how many chases is too many chases? And then people are chasing you going, oh, what are we getting for this book? And you go, well, I don't know. I've pitched it to 75 different people, but no one's replying to me. The wall of silence is the publicist's nightmare. So the fact that she would take the time to go, thanks, but no thanks. You're just like, thank you. That means I don't have to, this one more person, I don't have to email. I don't have to, but I just know, I know it's not going to be on news. I'm like, tick, right, fine, moving on. So I've always felt particularly warmly towards her just on that basis alone. And I thought the book was very good. If you're interested in journalism, if you're interested in how these interviews happen and what's going on in the background, then I really recommend it. It's very, very entertaining as well. So, yes.
I'm not at all interested in the, I didn't even watch Prince Andrew interview. I only know the like headline bits that have sort of filtered through.
It's depressing woking. Can't sweat.
Yeah, can't sweat. Yeah, can't sweat and Pizza Express. That's about it. But the other stuff sounds interesting. And yeah, I'm sort of interested in the background of it. I think that's probably the thing that most people would find entertaining if you're not involved in that sort of industry or adjacent to it or whatever.
Yeah,
it's quite interesting to find out how those things happen, isn't it?
Yeah. Julian Assange has a limp handshake. I don't think any of us are surprised, are we?
I have just got to say as well, on a personal note, that I am one of those people who doesn't reply. So I feel well truly ticked off now as well.
And my argument is, if the booker for Newsnight can take the time to reply, then other people can take the time to reply. Just say no, that's all we want. Because we can stop harassing you. We've got a lot of emails too, you know. I once said this on Twitter. And in fact, the thing that prompted it, and I didn't say this on Twitter, but the thing that prompted it was Sam McAllister replying to a picture of mine going, thanks, but no thanks. And I tweeted something like, all hail the people who take the time to say no. And like every book publicist on Twitter was just like, yes, yes. Oh, my God, yes. And then there were various journalists going, oh, well, if I tried to reply to every email I got, I'd never have time to do anything else. It's like, well, if you replied to your emails, you wouldn't have publicists emailing you for the fifth time going, are you going to cover my book? Oh, I'm not over it.
I'm just going to put you on mute, Kirsty.
Next week on Late to It, Kirsty's still going.
No, I'm in your email. I mean, I could put you on mute as well, since I edit it. I could just put you out. No, you don't actually email me. You just send me stuff. So.
I don't need to email. I know what you like.
Yes.
Oh, that sounded wrong.
Well, this week's definitely not a U-rated podcast, is it? Because we're getting deep into some trauma in a bit. So
we are.
Yeah, dear. Before that, though.
Yeah, what have you been reading?
Poetry Week. Yay!
Yay!
I have been reading Quiet by Victoria Aduke-Bulley, who I saw perform at Manchester Literature Festival quite a few years ago, like pre-pandemic, maybe 2018, I think. I'm guessing off the top of my head. And she was brilliant. So she was with two other young poets, Momtaz Mahera, and I wish I'd not started this now because I can't remember. I know who the other person was, Rachel Long, who we both love.
Yes.
So those three performed together and they were brilliant. And so Bully's is the last full collection, I think, to come out of the three of them. So I'd been looking forward to this and it's been shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize as well. So that's quite an achievement for a debut poet. So lots of it is about being a young Black woman. And there's some really interesting poems about being Black in the world that we live in. There are also a little trio of poems that are about snails, which I enjoyed.
Excellent.
Very much. I contemplated reading one of them, but I haven't, but I'm not going to. And they are just, they're really interesting and experimental. And we've talked before how much about I love experimental writing, and I really like that these poems, some of them like look like prose on the page, but they're not prose really. Ones with like spaces used really interestingly. There's one that's a erasure poem where she's taken somebody else's work and just stripped out the words that she doesn't want. There's some really interesting and inventive pieces of work in here. I really, really enjoyed it. I always feel like there's not like masters you can say about, like, go and read it. It's good. So I always read one out when we do this. So I wanted to read one that actually, even though I've said there's lots about young Black women, some of these, it's not all trauma and, you know, women versus things. So this one's from a little sequence called Girls in Arpeggio, and it's the last one in the sequence, I think. Yep. It's number 4, and it's called Real Politic. Somewhere beyond the last of the pencil lines, tattooed on the door frames of their kitchens, their only nations, these girls, caco cord and peppercorn pin curled, decide to call themselves beautiful. Not chocolate or caramel, not coconut or tan, not bounty, not Hovis best of both or burnt whole grain toast, not buff nor carbon cum diamond blick, not lighty nor hair enough to hang from, not video girl, not side chick, not thick, not booty or apple bottom, not deputation any longer, not another word, not vice nor hereafter, any cover teacher or standing nor prefix, no sign nor understudy, no other for beauty anymore. For these girls, it was a violent act. Afterwards, they slept better.
That's great. Really good.
Yeah, like I said, really inventive. I really, really, really enjoyed it.
So,
yeah.
Excellent. Good recommendation. I'm always keen to hear about poets because it's not something I follow religiously. Like, I feel like I know the big poetry collections that come out that get a lot of attention because they kind of break into the kind of mainstream book world. But those who, you know, don't so much, I think it's always good to hear about because it's not something I hear about every day. So thank you for that.
Very welcome.
Right, more trauma then.
We should do like all of the trigger warnings.
Yes. Once again, trigger warnings, yes. There are plenty of those here. So the two books we're talking about this week are Educated by Tara Westover, which was published by Penguin in 2018. I'm sure lots of people listening to this may already have read that, big bestseller. And The Incendiaries by R.O. Kwon, that was published by Virago, I think also in 2018, let me just check. Yes, 2018. Educated, which has just recently been reissued in a new edition, which is very quick to reissue, I have to say, with my publishing hat on. I was like, reissue already? But it has got the, it's got the American cover now, or a version of the American cover. They've moved away from that photographic look, and they've got, which is actually, it's very rare that I say this, but the American cover, I think, is the better cover. Mm. And it's this quite clever, I'm sure lots of people have seen it. It's a pencil, but in the pencil, it's a mountain and she's standing on the mountain. So it's very well done. Well done, that cover. Who designed the cover? Patrick Svensson. We don't often call out the jacket illustrators. So Patrick Svensson, well done. Good jacket. Oh, good.
I'm
illustration.
Full star anyway. From Kirsty.
Full star. That's the career validation you've been waiting for, isn't it? So as I said, this has been an enormous bestseller, and I'm sure if people listening to this haven't already read it, they will certainly have heard of it. But if you have been living under the proverbial rock, this is about Tara Westover, who grew up in very, very rural Idaho. She was born in the mid-80s. And her parents, particularly her father, were sort of radically survivalist. You know, there was like massive fuel tanks buried under the farm, and, you know, they did not believe in school. They didn't believe in doctors. The kids, she was one of seven. The kids never got birth certificates, or didn't until they were much older, kind of retrospectively. There was no, everything was sort of a tool of the government. You know, if the government finds out where we are, and, you know, kind of all those sort of cliches, and not cliches, but those stereotypes that you hear about these sort of American survivalists, like stocking up arms and fuel and enough canned peaches to last, whatever. that's where she grew up. So she grew up never going to school, never seeing a doctor. Her father was increasingly radical as she got older. She had one of her older brothers was very violent and very abusive. So eventually at the age of 16, Tara leaves home and basically decides that going to college is going to be her escape. She's never been to school, so she teaches herself enough to pass the entry test to Brigham Young, which is the Mormon University in Utah, and gets to Brigham Young, and then sort of goes on this sort of rather extraordinary educational journey where, you know, when she first starts at Brigham Young, she's never heard of the Holocaust, and people think she's making a terribly bad taste joke when she says in a class that she doesn't know what the word means, through to getting a scholarship to Cambridge, she's as you do. But yeah, it's quite harrowing in places. So I reiterate those trigger warnings. There's stuff there, particularly the abuse from her brother, is pretty difficult to read. But I ended up really, really liking the book. Enjoying feels like the wrong word to use, but I liked it a lot.
I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah.
The abuse, like we've talked about this before, you struggle to read abuse in fiction. And I'm fine when it's in fiction, and when it's non-fiction, I cannot, but like I really couldn't bear it.
Yeah.
And to the point that I got stomachache. So yeah. There's a bit where she ends up, so her dad, they seem to end up in loads of accidents, although some of these, I would dispute the word accident, even though I've just used it. Some of it is, well, even when they're in a car crash, so one of the first sort of accidents that happens, they're in a car crash, but her dad's decided to like drive all night, basically. So you just like, they are either foolish decisions by him or they are carelessness largely on his part, and that's when they get injured. And there's a bit when she's on this bin lorry, basically, that the dad's reversing, and he nearly kills her by crushing her into space where he's reversing. And at that point I ended up with stomachache because it just felt too much. So I struggled with that. The other thing was as well, I'm not saying it's not an interesting story, because it is, but and then the whole education thing. Now, this reminded me of Terry White, whose book you talked about on one of the earlier series. And I interviewed Terry about this time last year. And she talks about the fact that, so her book's about her alcoholism, about being sexually abused as a child, about becoming an editor. Eventually she edited Empire, but prior to that, she edited, she worked at Time Out. She had massive, you know, jobs. And we talked about, one, the fact that she very deliberately wrote what was a misery memoir, as in the Dave Peltzer All Scores style, ones that we've all, to some extent, moved away from, but she said she really wanted to depict that specifically. But also I said to her, you skip over the bit where you like get to university. And I said, for lots of us who were working class and perhaps grew up in traumatic households, that was our way out. And she said, yeah, but that's always the story, isn't it? And that's why I deliberately skipped it. And her Tara Westover's education story is interesting, but there's also some absolute bullshit around it that maybe we'll talk about in a bit. But I read it thinking it was an interesting story. But the other thing that bothered me, and perhaps this is the thing that bothered me more, was some of the quotes on the front. It was that feeling that, so we've got, I'm just going to call people out because why not? I know that some of these quotes have probably been probably been edited. But like Elizabeth Day, one of the best books I have ever read, unbelievably moving. And I'm like, well, maybe. On The Guardian, it says it will make your heart sore. And I'm like, will it though? Stylist calls it inspiring. And I'm like, to a point. The ones that really sort of bothered me. One of the wisest accounts of family love and betrayal that I read from the Mail. And I was like, okay. Stephen Fry called it marvellous. And I'm like, And again, I don't know if that's been edited, you know, but unlike Red, unflinching and fascinating. And I'm like, is that, and I have got like, I completely stand by Tara Westover's, the fact that she can write her own story. Like I'm totally with that. Anybody can write their own story in any way they want to. That's absolutely fine. I think, and the stuff that she learns when she sort of starts to realize, like it takes her ages. Other people have to say to her, as like we talked about a bit last week with the Lucia Osborne Crowley bit. Quite often it's not until somebody says to you, you realize that situation you were in was not normal, or it was abusive or whatever. And people have to say that to her. So the stuff that she learns and when she comes to those sort of realizations about her own family are interesting, because I found myself, again, it's that it depends how you connect with the book to some sense. But I'm like, I think my issue with it is this sort of thing as entertainment, and the way those quotes on the front suggest that people have read this because they found it entertaining, and I did not find it entertaining in that sense. I found it very difficult actually to read.
This is a general point, because I, again, enjoying is the wrong word, but I really liked Educated, and there were, yes, I mean the abuse was harrowing to read, but there was also things that I did find really, really interesting about it, and I ended up liking her a lot. And liking Tyler. We'll get on to Tyler, I'm sure. Good old Tyler, the one that stood by her. But as a general thing, yeah, those, I remember I worked in Waterstones in from 2000 to 2004, and that was like peak Dave Peltzer, Child called it. There were three of them. I can't remember what the other two were called, but I can picture the covers vividly. I can remember exactly where in the branch of the Waterstones that I worked in, and we'd have like a whole bay of it basically, and we could not keep it on the shelf. You know, we'd sell tons of them. I bought them for my own mum because I knew she'd like them, and she did. I never read the whole book, but I read bits of Child Called It, Child Named It. And it was horrific. I mean, horrific detail of child abuse. And I do not understand why you would read that as entertainment. But the thing is, there are, I mean, the trend for it, it feels like a terrible thing to call it, but you know, the peak of those books has passed, but they still sell. I mean, look at Kathy Glass. I mean, she's written God knows how many books, and they're bestseller, you know, Sunday Times bestsellers absolutely regularly. People still read that, you know, all the time. And I suppose to an extent, you look at true crime and you're, no, I've got more sympathy for true crime. None of this is coming out right today. But I suppose with that sort of thing, it's so far removed from day-to-day life. I mean, you can't necessarily imagine your next door neighbor or whatever doing it, but yeah, all of which to say is that sort of huge number of misery memoirs that appeared sort of 15-20 years ago, I don't get the appeal. And I think that's maybe why I haven't read Educated until now. It's a book I've meant to read. I was late to it, indeed, one might say. I think what makes her story particularly interesting is this rather extraordinary kind of trajectory from homeschool to Cambridge to Harvard to doctorate, because that is unusual. And people want to know how that happened. And I suppose that's, I imagine, where the inspirational thing comes from. But I think it is a tricky word to inspire. What does it inspire you to do? If you're calling something inspirational, what is it inspiring you to do? And I don't know what the answer to that is. What I did think was, you know, what I found most interesting about this book was seeing her deal with these kind of academic institutions, not just kind of the hallowed halls of Cambridge, but Brigham Young as well. You know, she's never been taught how to write an essay. she'd never been taught, you know, she'd never heard of, you know, she thought Europe was a country. She'd never heard of the Holocaust. She'd never heard of Caravaggio. I'm not sure when I heard of Caravaggio. I don't think I ever heard about him at school, to be honest. Glasgow wasn't big on teaching the masters. You know, she'd never heard of things that we find incredibly shocking that we haven't heard from, but that's just... That's... So the other thing... I'm going off on a tangent here. So what I also thought of when I read that was, have you read Trevor Noah's book, Born a Crime?
No.
So he tells this story in it from when he was a sort of teenage, late teenager maybe, where there used to be groups in that would dance and they'd get hired to go and dance at parties and they'd take a sound system and they'd like, so they were like DJs, but also they'd be dance crews as well and they'd be brought to parties to dance and then people would... And they got hired to do a, this school dance, and it was a Jewish school. Now, one of the names, one of the their star dancer, his name was Hitler. And that was because, as he explains it, you know, the Second World War was not taught in South Africa in the way that it is taught in Europe. We, you know, they knew that there'd been this war. They knew that there was this big political strongman called Hitler, but they didn't know the link between the two. They didn't really know who he was. They didn't know certainly that 6 million Jews had been annihilated. But the sort of, there was a kind of, not trend, but a kind of, lots of people in South Africa at that time, maybe in other African countries, I don't know, they would name their children after big important figures to kind of as an inspirational thing. So this kid was named Hitler because he was this big political strongman. They didn't know what he'd done. And so there's this farcical moment where there's all these dancers and they're all shouting, "Go Hitler, go Hitler," at a Jewish school, not understanding why all the teachers, like the basically teacher ran and like cut the power, like, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" Getting, they all got chucked out. And they said that it wasn't till later we realised the time they just thought they were being racist, you know. And it's that, it's that idea. It's, you know, we have, it's predicated on what you were taught, right? So, you know, it's that, obviously for very different reasons, but it's what kind of education do you value?
Yeah, and I had a big thing with this in the book. So, and this is absolutely not Sarah Westover's fault at all. This is the system. So she turns up and she sort of gets taken under the wing of this, one of the professors who then, or one of the teachers, who when she applies, he tells her to apply for the Cambridge scholarship and she doesn't get it. But he can take one person. So he takes her because he thinks it's going to make the biggest difference to her, which perhaps it is. But also there's a bit of that sort of savior nonsense going on, I felt. And then she gets to Cambridge and the academic who's responsible for her, who I assume we were supposed to know, but I ain't got a clue who he is, so I don't care. who's like, you know, very celebrated intellectual historian. That's right. Yeah. I had to look up what intellectual history was because I didn't know. Anyway, and he starts off by saying, oh, he's got a real life Pygmalion. And I literally wanted to slap him at that point because I was like, what on earth? And then the next page, basically, she's written this essay for him and he says it's one of the best essays that he's read in 30 years. And then she talks about from her perspective that she doesn't hear the rest of the commentary because she's expecting to be told that she's done something wrong. And that's to do with her family background and the trauma more than the thoughts about education, I think. So we never find out why he says that. And I wondered whether the reason that he said that was because actually she's come to that as an original thinker because she hasn't absorbed all the stuff that other people have done. She, like you said, she hasn't been taught to write in the way that you're taught to write academically. And I know you said before we were teaching, and I think you've mentioned it before, Ania, that that's been your issue with education, how when you're reading all this stuff that's been published, do you then figure your way through that to have an opinion of your own? And it's something that I have to do with my education trainees a lot because they take on what's been written about certain educational practices and think because somebody has written it and it's been published that that's right, or that, you know, the best thing to do or whatever. And I'm like, well, that's not necessarily going to work for your class in your school in your whatever. So I actually wanted to know more about that bit and what happened. And I sort of found this sort of idea about that being inspirational. And again, she gets a leg up through him as well. So he writes her a letter of recommendation. So she gets into another program, which I'm like, you know, it wasn't a, like I was reading it begrudging it, but I was like, this doesn't happen to like your average person. So if you're seeing that as inspirational, well, there's no way that route's going to ever open up for anybody else. It was just specific to her, and that a bit of that, like, he is this, you know, redneck. It was that sort of thought that, you know, here's somebody who's not had any education, who like we can do something for. And then it did feel a bit like they were doing it because it looked good on them. I don't know if I'm being uncharitable at that point. But yeah, I had big questions about the education system and the way and what they were doing during that. Yeah.
I think that's what I really liked reading about her time at university, because that sort of lack of confidence and is absolutely something I related to. I mean, I loved being at university in education. That's why I kept going back. I really, really did. But I think the reason, I mean, I did perfectly fine. Obviously, I got 2.1, and then I did a postgrad and I got a decent mark. It wasn't out of this world. And I think the reason that I sort of never, I didn't get beyond a certain level is that I was too scared to have my own thoughts. And, you know, how dare I disagree with someone who is in a book like that? You know, I could not possibly come up with something that those people who have, you know, studied for many more years than me and written books about it could have thought. How dare I have an opinion? And it was almost like I couldn't have an opinion, let alone an express it. And she says at one point, she's writing this essay on the Federalist Papers, and she says about making that shift from moving from reading books to know what to think to reading books to know how to think. And that's the leap that I'm not sure I ever satisfactorily made while I was in education. There is part of me would love to go back and redo my degree, and, you know, with kind of much more confidence. And then I go, well, why though? Why do you need that? Get that validation? Do you know what I mean? That sort of the pat on the head and go, yes, good essay, well done. And that's something about myself that, you know, I'm interrogating when that kind of, because I could go back and read all the books I read at university. And if I really wanted to write an essay, I'm sure I could write an essay for my own, you know, benefit. So why do I want to go back and sort of get the pat on the head from the academics 20 years after the fact? Interesting. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I shouldn't touch on that thread.
I was going to say I could do your therapy session if you want, because I went back to get my PhD for exactly the same reason.
Yeah.
And it's all to do with not having that validation when I was younger. And which is why I think Tara Westover is now a professor. Is she a professor?
She's certainly got a PhD. She's
works as an academic. I did look up. So she wrote a really interesting piece, actually. I should have mentioned this. So there was a piece in, I think it was the New York Times. So we talked about before, normally I don't go looking for stuff around the book, but I did for this because I'm more interested in her than I am in some of the other stuff. But yeah, she wrote about this idea that people have got about the book and the trajectory that she went on. She didn't write the book to go, this is what you can do, because actually you can't. And she says she talks about the system being the issue, not the fact that she didn't have any schooling for years and then she, you know, became an academic. Yeah, she's worked at Harvard and Cambridge, I think I'm right in saying. But it's to do with validation, isn't it? And she gets some validation from that, but I think she gets something more from that, because one of the things that happens at the end, so she's, her dad is abusive, one of her elder brothers, Sean, is horrifically abusive as well. She gets gaslit, so there's a point where you think it's going to resolve, and her sister writes to her and says, did all this happen, did I imagine it? And she's like, no, you're right, this is what went on. And they both agree they're going to talk to her mum. And then the sister writes back and says she's already done it, like Tara wants to wait for her. And her mum sends her this message saying, you know, I should have protected you, it was my fault. And then it turns out she hasn't said anything to the dad. I mean, it's pure like narcissist behavior, that saying that this has happened and then having not. And then she ends up in a like worse situation with her dad and her brother, because she goes back home several times, even though she's left to go to university. And I mean, her dad does shitty things, like she gets a job packing bags at a local supermarket, and then he says basically if she's doing that, he's going to kick her out, so then she won't get the money to go back to university if she does that. And that, yeah, and I think, I mentioned this at the beginning, but her sort of realisation of what's going on and getting herself, so what she really gets out of education is working out who she wants to be, what she wants her life to look like. And it's interesting that the point where she finally says to her mum and dad that she can't do this anymore, that she can't be part of this traumatic cycle that they keep propelling, I guess. Mm-hmm. They're in a dormitory. I mean, they were staying in a bloody hotel, and they've made loads of money by this point because of her dad has this fucking horrific accident that literally for like however many pages of the book, I was convinced that he had got to be dead. It's so bad. He basically melts half his face off. And obviously he won't go to the hospital. He won't have anybody come out to him. All he gets is these tinctures that her mum makes. And so then they make all this money because like he's survived and it must be down to these. He's like, oh my God. But they're loaded.
That's the thing, there's so many accidents in it. And as you say, accidents being the sort of quote unquote, there's a lot of carelessness and what have you. But there's like, there's two car accidents. There's Tara being knocked off that thing that her dad's driving. Her brother Sean falls off a forklift truck. He then crashes his bike. At one point, she can actually see his brain coming out of his head. Someone's jeans go on fire because they've been splashed with petrol and have to get peeled off them. None of them go to the hospital for anything. Well, apart from the very, very serious accident with Sean, the two of them. But he's brought home at the phone.
Sorry, I was going to say, even then it's only because Tara defies everyone else and takes him there.
And then they bring him home at the first opportunity, because obviously they don't have insurance. They bring him home at the first possible opportunity and say they'll nurse him at home. Her mum is a self-taught midwife that just uses, you know, home remedies. All these horrific medical things happen, but they all survive. That was almost the most unbelievable bit of it. Like, they come close to death so many times and just they never actually die. It's like, hang on, what's in those tinctures?
God's will, clearly.
God's will, obviously. Clearly. But there's some pretty gruesome like when her dad does like burn half his face off in this explosion. They have to keep going back and cutting the dead flesh off. So trigger warning for that detail.
After the event. and that whole, I mean, that's, it is because he's completely careless. And there's a point, so this is a bit of a spoiler, but I mean, we've talked about pretty much everything that's in the book anyway. You're either going to read it or you're not, I think. But again, that happens because he's been utterly careless, like completely. And it's not even like, there's a bit about, you know, health and safety, it's terrible. He just doesn't even think about it. And then, so one of the things that happens to Tara later on is she comes across ideas about being bipolar, and all of a sudden her dad's behaviour makes sense to it. But as I was saying to you before we started recording, being bipolar does not make you an absolute bellend. Like, it's not even that it's beyond like manic behaviour. It is abusive, violent, you know, destructive, like really destructive. It's not just the sort of, you know.
No, I dare say behaviour. His behaviour is exacerbated by certainly some pretty obvious unmedicated mental issues. But, you know, having bipolar and being a dickhead are not mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
But this is, I mean, that's actually something that I found very interesting. And this is possibly where we segue slightly into The Incendiaries, because I think this kind of speaks to both books. For all that we do see all this horrific abuse, and horrific abuse, particularly by Sean, we also see these moments of tenderness. We see these flashes of, like, with her dad, who's been dead set against education, thinks the fact that she's going to college means she's going to be infiltrated by Californian socialists.
The Illuminati.
You know, Edith, it's not God's will, they're all godless and socialist, and it's funny how all godless people are left wing.
We are, though.
Yeah, we are. You know, but then every so often there'll be a flash of kind of, there's a point where she doesn't think she's going to be able to pay the next term's tuition fees, and her dad sort of very quietly says, you know, I'll find you the money. And then 5 minutes later is just as abusive as he's always been. So there's these occasional flashes, again, her relationship with Sean, who physically abuses her, is violent and horrific, not just to her, but to basically every woman in his life. But then they spend this period of time long distance trucking together. And there's these really affectionate bits where he calls her Sid or Lister and like teaches her this, you know, code language, and is really warm and affectionate. And it's quite difficult to reconcile those moments with the abuse that they perpetuate. But actually what this is just showing that even the worst people are rounded humans. But also pointing out that we shouldn't be any easier on them just because occasionally they show a flash of humanity. And this is something I think we see again in The Incendiaries, which is fiction. But the basic idea, again, this is another book around religious extremism and Christian extremism, where Will, who is our main narrator, has left behind a childhood as a born-again Christian, has left his Bible college and has transferred to a college in New York. I can't remember what college, I don't know if it's a real college or not, probably not. There he has met Phoebe, who had been a kind of prodigious piano talent, but has given up playing the piano. And she is sort of caught up in this Christianity-based cult that is also linked to North Korea. She's Korean. South Korea. This cult goes on under the influence of this sort of charismatic leader called John Leal. They kind of get more and more extreme in their behaviours and ultimately blow up an abortion clinic. And Will, who sort of becomes Phoebe's boyfriend, recognises these patterns of extremism from his own background, and is trying to sort of get Phoebe out, while at the same time talks about how much he misses his faith in certain things. And he also does abhorrent things. They're all awful characters. But again, we've got another example of seeing all sides of people. And so when someone you feel like you have come to see the humanity in does something abhorrent, blows up an abortion clinic, does whatever, it's what makes it so jarring, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing, that in real life, that's why it's, when people go, well, why didn't she leave? Well, that's one of the reasons, is because you get those moments where somebody behaves in a perfectly, not even just a perfectly reasonable manner, in a completely loving manner, and then it's just confusing if you're on the other end of it and it's someone that you think should care for you. Yeah, the incendiary as well, I hate it all. And I don't think I really got past that, to be honest. So this was a reread for me. And when I read it, so I read it when it came out, I read it in hardback and thought it was superb. And I stand by that in terms of the writing is very, very good. Very good.
Yeah, we love our Oakwan. She's great.
Yes. But I'd forgotten how horrible they all were. And I started rereading it and I just thought, I do not give a shit about any of you. Which became a bit of a problem. Like, if it had been the first time I was reading it, I think perhaps I'd been slightly more tolerant of them. But I was just like, oh, no, you're all vile. I don't want anything to do with it. I think especially because they're such rich kids and privileged little shits. And even, like, well, they are, which is why they think they can go around, like, blowing up abortion clinics. Fucking hell. I mean, Will doesn't even come from that background, but very quickly when he gets to the college, like, he realises he's out of step, because he says, they're talking about how they got there, and he's talking about, like, how many buses he got from California, and they look at him like, you know, he's some weirdo. And so he just takes his mum's previous background and makes it his own. So he completely lies about, you know, who he is and where he's come from. And Phoebe works this out at one point and is like, why have you been lying to me? And you're like, well, would you have had anything to do with him if he hadn't lied to you about where he'd come from?
It's a bit of a trope with the campus novel, isn't it? It's that sort of, there's always the fish out of water. There's the poor kid who's got there by sheer grit and determination, and they're trying to fit in and bloody, bloody, blah. I feel like I've read quite a few of those recently in one way or the other. But, I mean, it's really interesting. He's this character who, because it's mostly from his perspective, most of the book is from his perspective, and the bits that aren't from his perspective sort of start out being from his perspective, like what I imagine Phoebe would have said to John Leal when she was doing this was. So you're always slightly in that question of, did she say that, or is this just speculation? So you get to know him, and you, in many ways, you begin on his side, because you can see that Phoebe's sort of falling into the trap of John Leal and his little kind of society. You can see that she is being taken in by his very obvious lies and the charisma of him, and he's this presence. And I thought actually it'd be really interesting reading this next to The Startup Wife, actually, with Cyrus and the kind of this kind of messianic sort of complex, although this is much more malign, you know, and sort of knowingly so than Startup Wife. But then Will goes on to do really awful things himself. There's this terrifying bit when he's away doing an internship in China, and he just starts following this woman down the street, and it's really shocking, because up to that point, I mean, yeah, he's a bit of a dick, but you're kind of like, he's doing the right, he's on the side of the good, he's trying to get Phoebe away from this awful person, but then he becomes the awful person.
He's got a real abandonment complex because he wants Phoebe to go, doesn't she? And then she can't go because she's not got the grades that she needs. So she stays, but clearly she's hanging out with John Leal while while Will's not there. And then there's the point where she's going to leave him, and he rapes her.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, she does leave after that, but he rapes her first. So, yeah, and at that point, like, you've lost all sympathy for him, I think, or at least I had.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah, of course.
Yeah, so then you're sort of not on anybody's side at that point. They're all, well, I guess at that point you're on Phoebe's for a little bit, and there's a whole bit with Will where he goes, she can't possibly have done this thing she's being accused of doing, which is quite interesting that he sees her. And I think there's a little bit of that. He almost sees her as someone who needs rescuing, because and she has had such a privileged life in that because she's been hothoused as this pianist, which she's given up doing because she couldn't be the very best, like, basically in the world. So she stopped playing, even though she's clearly, like, incredibly talented. But she's never even, she don't know how to cut an apple up because she's never had to do it. Her mum just used to bring them in on a plate for her so she could carry on while, like, practicing.
Yeah.
So I think he sees her as something to be rescued. And then when she's not, or, like, she's under John Leal's spell instead, so she, her behaviour's changed, then that's where his behaviour towards her changes.
Yeah, which, and his, and Will's sort of need to rescue her, while you can see that she does need to be got away from John Leal, at the same time, there are so many echoes of that sort of Christian missionary, save her, but save her and bring her to the side of the light. That it's also quite icky, even if you want her to be got away from that group. And given his kind of relationship, you know, his previous background, where he was absolutely this kind of proselytizing Christian who converted his own mum, you know, he understands that manipulation, but is, I think, increasingly frustrated that it's not working. You know, he's not able to convince Phoebe away from the one he doesn't want her to be with, and that is increasingly frustrating for him, which probably culminates in what he does.
Yeah. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, and you touched on it there, was the way that it's narrated. So, like you said, it's mostly Will's perspective, but what happens if is we get further and further away from the other? So Will's always sort of the presence, but Phoebe's story is told via Will. So John Leal basically gets them all to talk about their stories. So it's Phoebe telling her story as Will imagines it, which is clearly, like, could be bullshit. We don't know if any of that's true. And then John Leal's sort of a third person narrator who tells us about his behavior. So everybody's at a remove, which is kind of interesting in that you never quite get to the core of the cult and what's going on. I mean, you hear bits about what they've done, and obviously you see a bit where Phoebe's got, she's basically been whipped and she's got marks on her back. And then at the end, one of the other people gets sort of taken out by their parents because they've withdrawn a massive amount of money, figure out that something's happening, and they've got the same marks on their legs. So you get these sort of flashes, but you never really, you're not exposed to that sort of heart of it and what actually is, how they've actually convinced. And you see them, I mean, there is the bit, they go on marches, they go on pro-life marches, at which point I was rolling my eyes, which is probably not the appropriate response to it, but you're just like, oh, for fuck's sake. So yeah, and it's that whole thing, isn't it? I mean, clearly she wanted to make a point about American in particular, but I know it's becoming more prominent here too, that we're pro-life, but what we're going to do is blow up an abortion clinic and five young women are going to die. That makes perfect sense. That's definitely pro-life.
Absolutely. I thought it was very interesting on religion and sort of what people get out of it. I've found this, as I've mentioned before, I grew up when my mum was a Christian. I was brought up going to church, I was brought up going to Sunday school until I had my sort of anti-Damascene conversion when I was in my mid-teens. But I understand the attraction of it. I understand the attraction of having a faith, of being able to have something to collectively believe in, to make sense of the weird shit that happens in the world. Do you know what I mean? And that's something that both Phoebe and Will experience, because one of the thing that sort of, I think, fully cements Phoebe as part of this group is when John Leal tells her that she should go swimming every morning and she should do X number of laps every day or swim for this certain amount of time. And she finds in that the kind of repetitiveness and solace and routine and structure that she missed from when she was practicing piano, when she used to just practice piano all the time. And so that calms her, and I think probably pushes her towards John Leal and the cult. At the same time, Will, who starts trying to go to meetings ostensibly as a way to figure out how to get Phoebe away from them, to sort of to find the silver bullet to prove that they are manipulating her. But several times he talks about how jealous he is of it, you know, that he remembers that sort of comfort and collectiveness and, you know, the community from when he was an active Christian, and sort of he finds himself slightly wishing that he could believe in the cult himself. And I found that really, I thought that was a really interesting insight into what the purpose of religion can be. I mean, you know, my mum found a huge amount of comfort from religion. And I remember thinking, you know, God, that would be lovely. But I could never believe in it. So I wasn't part of it. But then, of course, the flip side is the horrific things that are done sort of in the same name.
Yeah, the other thing that is it made me think of as you were talking was that bit. So Will works in a restaurant. That's the thing that he's not told Phoebe that she finds out about and then is furious about. But the guy who owns the restaurant is an absolute prick. And it's a restaurant that like really rich people go to eat at. And he tells Will that they are there because they're buying into an illusion. Like it's not, they're not going down KFC for some food just because they need to eat. They're going there because of the way they look, the way they're seen. And it feels like actually that idea of an illusion is also what the religion's creating. So it's, there's the capitalist illusion, there's the religious illusion. I suppose it's a comment on how you organize your life, isn't it? And if you're buying into things that you want to be a certain thing rather than the reality of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is the same somewhat in an educated. I mean, she says in the author's note at the beginning of that, it's not really a book about religion, but it in so many ways it is. From that same perspective.
Yeah. Oh, dad buys into a total illusion. Is that bonkers bit where he's decided that he doesn't want anything to do with money? Because money's made up, so he goes and gets some silver and some gold. And I'm like, well, that's not made up, but the currency, the way you use it, is still made up. Like, we invented it. It's a human invention. It's not, like, still not real.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that we exchange money is just a... I forgot what they call it. There is a proper term for it. But it's symbolic rather than an actual thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. People are weird, Kirsty.
People are weird. If we've learned nothing from either of these books, it's that it's people are weird. Speaking of weird, next week, last week again. Ooh. So soon. I'm holding them here. We've got two absolute chunks. So for our last week on Late to It, we've got some weirdness. We have The Dollmakers by Nina Allen, and we have Plain Bad Heroines by Emily M. Danforth.
I'm looking forward to them, but they are chunky.
They are chunky, but I am really looking forward to both of them. And I'm particularly looking forward to The Dollmaker because I've got proof, I've had this for so long and not read it. And every time I have been in contact with the book's publicist, Anna McLaughlin, hello, I have gone, I'm so sorry, I know you sent me that book in late 2018, but I haven't read it yet. And I will finally be able to say, Anna, I have read The Dollmaker.
I'm going to be a bit of an arse about this. Anna sent me a finished copy, so I got it a bit later than you, but still have it. And it's beautiful as well. But also, and this was a very bizarre moment for me when I found this out, Nina Allen follows my blog. Now, obviously, I've not posted on my blog for a long time, but I was quite surprised and think, like, she's quite an incredible writer, I think, generally. So that was a little bit of a, oh my God, moment for me. So I'm very excited to discuss one of her books on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. And I'm really looking forward to Plain Bad Heroines, which I bought. So I've not had this quite as long. I bought this when it came out. but haven't read it, but has one of my favourite covers probably of the last couple of years, which is just big and yellow and pink and has a big B on it. And I just think it's a very good cover.
I love that you're holding that up.
Hello, like anyone can see it. Please know that I'm holding it up and I'm very happy about it.
Superb. In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Kirsty's still on Twitter at The Other Kirsty. We're both on Instagram. Kirsty is at Other Kirsty. No, other. I'm at Naomi Frisby. But I'm locked and I might not let you in. I'm such a dick about it, but I am. There you go. We'll see you next week for the last episode in the series. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.